Well, welcome to another issue of Launch, where businesses take off. This is Ron Reardon. Jim is on sabbatical today, and we also have our producer, Lee Cantor. Hey, Lee.
How are you doing today, Ron, running the show? Yeah. A little nervous?
No, not nervous anymore. And we have a very special guest, Jackie Hunter, who's an IP strategist. Hey, Jackie.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing fine. Well, Jackie, looking at your bio and everything, it says that you call yourself a recovering patent attorney. Why do you call yourself that?
Well, the first step to any recovery is knowing there's a problem. And after close to 15 years in the business, at the highest levels, both in corporate and in private practice, I realized there was a whole lot of value being created for the lawyers, but often not a whole lot of value created for clients. And being able to reach out to folks and understand and get a sense of other people were disappointed too. And there was and is a growing community of folks who say, you know, the old way of doing stuff isn't the right way, and there's got to be a better way to serve clients other than the traditional legal IP service legal model.
Okay, that sounds good. And you call yourself an IP strategist. Exactly what is IP strategy?
Well, an IP strategist gets paid even if they say no. I think that is the quickest way to identify what the fundamental difference is. Because, unfortunately, historically, lawyers get paid, IP lawyers specifically, but also all lawyers in general, get paid by the hour billed. So, by definition, if somebody comes to you and says, should I get a patent? If it is patentable or if there is a legal basis to provide IP protection, typically the answer is going to be yes. But this is not unethical. There's nothing wrong with this. This is just the nature of the beast. It's a business model problem that needs to be fixed. And the way that I, as well as others, see the ability to fix it is to deal with IP in a consulting model, or more simply perhaps, that everybody needs an in-house lawyer, not everybody can afford a full-time in-house lawyer. So this model provides in-house, high-level in-house strategic counseling on a, if you will, methodology.
Okay. How does, like Ron's a patent agent and you're a patent attorney, what's the difference between you guys?
Great question.
Besides your rate, I would imagine.
My former rate. Well, interestingly, the area of patent practice is the only practice model today where somebody who's not an attorney can hold themselves out as somebody who's legally authorized to practice.
So there aren't like divorce agents?
No, exactly not. Ron is, patent attorneys have dual certification. We are, if we're a patent attorney or if we're an attorney, we're certified by one or more states having taken the bar, and we've passed the test. We haven't done anything really bad, and so they give us our license. Patent attorneys also take a second exam, which is put out by the U.S. Patent Office, and we're certified to practice before the Patent Office. So Ron is not an attorney, but he is certified to do your work on your behalf to
the
patent office.
So that's the same. You both took that same test?
Exactly the same.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But a big qualification is that Ron and folks who are patent agents in general are limited in the type of advice that they can provide. He cannot technically provide advice to whether you infringe somebody's patent. He can't technically do confidentiality agreements and other things. That is the province of lawyers.
Mm-hmm. But I can give a patentability opinion.
Yes, you can. Right.
And that would be the same as yours, right, based on your knowledge of patents, because like a lawyer's knowledge about lawyering is so broad, but a patent is so narrow, and you both have to pass that narrow test, right?
Yes, but what I like about Ron is he's got 30 plus years of business experience, and he mm-hmm. doesn't check that at the door, so he's got a very broad-based perspective on this thing, more so than somebody I think would have just coming out of school.
Right.
And, you know, we talked earlier about questions, you know, and asking the right questions. there's a difference between asking the question, is it patentable and is it sellable and marketable? Because I think even Thomas Edison said, if it won't sell, I'm not interested in inventing it.
And that's fundamentally the issue with traditional model of IP legal services. And, you know, I was one. I was I had a very nice office in Midtown Atlanta several people reporting directly to me, and was quite honestly very well compensated. And incomparably at the senior in-house level, it was a pretty good gig, as they say. But at the end of the day, my job was to assess whether something was patentable or whether somebody was infringing or whether they needed an agreement, not whether this was a good thing to do. Patent practice, IP practice, is primarily in that model, is getting it through from a very technical level, not whether it's the right thing to do.
Right. And can you tell us what some of the mistakes are that people typically make when they're getting their IP?
Well, you're talking from the launch perspective, the entrepreneurial model.
Right.
Well, very often folks come up with a problem, and they identify a problem, come up with a solution, and then they go down the patenting process. They get a patent search, and quite often they think that an inexpensive patent search will give them the answer.
They typically just on their own go to Google or something. Is that what you find?
No, what often happens, unfortunately, is folks will go online and say, you know, there's a $300 patent search or a, you know, $800 patent search.
Oh, those are like online businesses that
exactly.
Kind of prey upon these people.
Well, I don't know if it's preying. I don't want to.
Or helping them.
Yeah, they're helping them at various degrees.
In a questionable way.
But what people don't realize when they get a patent search done that's in a vacuum like that is that all these folks are looking at is whether or not there are other patents in that same box, in that same file cabinet, if you will, although it's electronic now in the patent office. There's no context, there's no analysis of whether or not there's something in an adjacent file cabinet that just was outside of the immediate rubric. So what folks do is they come to me and say it's patentable, and I look at it and I go, there's no way you can get a patent that's broad enough to cover your business model with this.
But that's because you have years of working in this space, so you can kind of tell at a glance.
Exactly. And that's something that somebody with a lot of experience, you know, from Ron's perspective, business, he's seen a lot of patents over the years and seen a lot of business models come and go. And somebody like me, quite honestly, I can usually pick up a patent and say, without reading very much of it and knowing whether it's a strong patent, a weak patent, whether or not, quite honestly, whether somebody would be interested in buying it. And it's the same thing with front-end, early-stage business ideas.
Mm-hmm.
But lawyers, jobs, and I have friends at the highest level of practice who I still send work to at several hundred dollars an hour. This is not a criticism, but I've had these conversations with them. Somebody who's a dear friend of mine at a very prestigious law firm here in town, I asked her not so long ago, I said, you know, you got to tell me, if somebody comes to you with a patentable idea, do you ask them why they're doing it? And she said, no, that's not my job. I have to assume that the business people who are driving the decision-making process
right,
to come to me
have it all figured out. Right.
But what you learn over the years is that most people don't know it. And
right.
Because patents and IP, it's kind of arcane and weird, and patents are written in different language, that people generally just say, oh, let the lawyers take care of it. And that's gotten us into the position
right.
We are now.
And also, it's kind of since you can tell at a glance something, how can you be paid hourly for it?
That is perfect. I love that. I'm gonna quote you on that. But exactly. It's and there's a story. Ron, would you tell the story you told me last week? I love that story.
Oh, yeah. Steinmetz, the electrical genius, many, many years ago, he was engaged by this company that had this gigantic generator that was producing about 10% of the power it was supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
They had all the young kids in there trying to figure it out, and they couldn't figure it out. So they brought him in. He comes in, and he listens. He says, get me a stepladder, some wire clippers, you know, and a screwdriver. And he gets on the stepladder, goes to a panel, undoes it, takes a couple of winds of wire off of an armature, puts it back in, and it goes to 100% power. And they're just like, wow, this is incredible. You're just a genius, you know, which he was. And he sends them a bill for $10,000.
Right.
And they freak out. They're like, you were only here
for a minute.
For a couple
right.
of minutes. Right. Why are you charging us? He says, well, do you want an itemized bill? Right. And they said, yes. Mm-hmm. And he said, okay. $10. You know, unscrewing the thing, undoing the wire, cutting it. $9,990, knowing where to do that,
exactly.
And they paid the bill.
Right. Amen. I mean that's why you pay for expertise. We talk about that all the time, that you can save a person how much time by just at a glance telling them this is a go or no go.
Well, it just depends on the circumstance. But one great example, and he may be listening, so hi, how are you doing? Mm-hmm. But a startup company CEO called me a few weeks ago, and he just been reading my blog, and we may be talking about social media later, but the blog's been very very beneficial for getting this new business model out. But he came to me and he said, hey Jackie, I know you get it. I'm a new CEO. I've got to figure out whether to go out and collect, hit my investment community for this new medical device. And he says, I know nothing about patents, but the strength of this pending patent application is critical to my going out and getting
right. That'll help him validate the whole thing.
So, and that was great that he actually realized that was an initial question.
Right.
But he didn't want to go out there and do that. So he says, "Would you look at it?" And I said, "Yeah, I can do that." And he actually had a decent, very well known, I should say, somebody I know very well as a lawyer. I said, "Oh, shouldn't be a problem." And so and so is a very good lawyer, and you've got a good law firm doing it now. So I honestly don't expect law problems, but I'll look at it for you. So I looked at the it took me just very, very short period of time. But bottom line is I looked at the application, and I was able to say, gosh, this is a really, really cool innovation in a medical device. Unfortunately, the innovation is not captured in the patent application. And so what is going to happen is that you're going to get a patent that issues that's going to be very narrow. And so your competitors are going to be able to say, hey, we'll just knock
this around the edges.
Exactly.
Right?
And the basis of this investment was for an exit to sell to a large company. Why would a large company buy
them? They wouldn't, because they can knock it off themselves.
But the other issue there was that I saw that...
but did you coach him on how to maybe protect himself?
Yes, we're actually going to be doing that. Should he decide to move forward, is there actually, it's very early stage. The inventor's just got the basic inventive concept. But there are going to be lots of peripheral inventions, lots of ancillary improvements that are going to be necessary to make this thing go to market. So what I am telling him is that if you do decide to prototype this, if you do decide to take investment to go ahead for the prototype, work very closely with me. And the innovation company is going to be doing the work for you, and we will brainstorm and we will figure out how to build protection that basically builds a fence through protection around this very narrow patent at the end of the day.
Right.
But also the second piece of this is I was able to look at this. So I told him, I said, it needs to issue, but it's going to issue. It's going to be very narrow. You need to do something else. So let's be strategic about
that. So something in addition to it, not instead of it.
Something that's necessarily needed. So like, for example, if it needs to, they don't know this yet because they actually haven't prototyped it. But if their turns, ends up being a feature that is critical to making this a commercially viable product, then patent the heck out of that. And so anybody somebody could go ahead and do a knockoff product of the invention, but it wouldn't be commercially relevant because they wouldn't be able to.
Right, they'd need this critical component.
Exactly,
right.
Exactly. And that's part of the strategy piece. But the other piece on here is that I was able to tell him very quickly that this, notwithstanding the fact it was narrow, it needed to go through, but the current way that the attorney was handling the action in the patent office was very, very poor. And they were going to end up spending years fighting it because it was a viable argument, but it was a bad argument.
Right.
They were going to end up spending years, lots and lots of money. I put a $25,000 to $40,000 price tag on the ongoing work in the patent office. It was going to sit for 3 years, and they were going to lose.
Right.
I could tell they were going to lose. So what I said is, you need to reorient the prosecution. You need to turn it over to another attorney, and actually be strategic about how you push this patent application.
So, but he thought initially that he was doing the right thing by hiring this big firm and getting these well-known people, but they don't know the strategy element of it as well as you do.
There was a patentable invention.
Right.
They wrote.
Right, they just looked at it very black and white. Yes, this can be patented, yes. And then they went through the process, but they didn't really kind of work it out strategically.
And now they're in the foxhole of arguing with the patent examiner,
right.
And you totally lose sight. I can tell you, I've done this for years. You right. totally lose sight of why you're fighting with the patent examiner.
Exactly.
Yeah. And Jackie, I've read one of your blogs, and you were talking in that particular blog about a frustrated CEO that had an issued patent, and he had competition that come off with a knockoff product, but his patent didn't cover it because the patent covered a very unique formulation and everything that the R&D people thought was cool, and then the knockoff did it inexpensively. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, and thank you for mentioning my blog. It's IPAssetMaximizerBlog.com. The issue was a major consumer products company. I know them. I know the folks there fairly well. And he expressed frustration to me because they had spent years and years of development work developing a new plastic material for a product. And it was a pretty darn cool. I'm a chemist, so for me it was a pretty, I agreed, it was a pretty cool plastic product, and it did some really cool things. And they came out with a product that met the consumer need. It had the structural characteristics, and it did what it was supposed to do. Unfortunately, and I should back up, the consumer loved it. The consumer loved it, said this is a really great product. Unfortunately, the consumer did not love it enough to pay the price that was required to actually profitably sell the product, and it absolutely died in the marketplace after millions and millions of dollars of development work.
Right.
But and they had literally spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on patent protection throughout the world, various different iterations, all focused toward the chemical formulation. And so this kind of sat there for a while, and they but then they started seeing a large competitor starting to introduce a product
that looked a little similar.
That actually performed. That actually performed exactly the same way.
Exactly the same way.
And what this competitor was able to do was use the large company's my friend's company's product as a model, and say this is the standard that we need to meet with regard to performance, but it's too expensive. Let's figure out how to take the cost out of the chemical formulation.
Right.
And so what ended up happening is the competitor was able to introduce a product with almost as good, probably not as good, but
right,
as good.
Right, so like 80%.
Yeah, exactly. Well. And the consumer didn't notice a difference.
Good enough.
And it was much cheaper, much, much cheaper. Mm-hmm. And the consumer product leader said, business leader said, why can't I sue them? I said, because all these wonderful patents you got cover the invention, not the innovation.
Right. So could he protect himself by covering the innovation, or that's not patentable?
It actually would have been patentable if they would have addressed the issue from a standpoint of performance and mm-hmm. function. A product that has these functional parameters, and then build the formulations, build whatever else into those parameters.
Right.
And they're out of luck. They cannot go after the competitor. What's even worse, though, and
could the competitor patent what they're doing?
Yes,
and then just kind of lock up the whole market?
Probably, because they were able to do it much more effectively.
Right.
At a much lower cost.
They had a roadmap.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right,
and that Ron Mate brings up a very good point. When competitors knock you off, or anybody knocks you off, it's even worse for you. Not only are they copying you and taking your market or whoever else, they're actually doing it for a lot cheaper than you had to do it for.
They don't have the learning curve that you had to
exactly.
go through to figure it
and
out.
They've got the market already made,
right.
And they say, hey, here, take this.
Right.
And, because we can tell you it works because so-and-so.
And then they can sell it easier. It's like that, but cheaper, so they don't have to, explain it as much.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I think the key learning there is to patent the innovation, not the invention.
And it's not always possible to do that, to Lee's point that could they have done it? And I'm like, well, maybe not as broadly as they would have liked,
mm-hmm.
but I guarantee you if you don't start with that, with trying to, from that perspective, trying to do that, you're not going to end up with it.
Right.
So you've got to ask that question. And your lawyers, your IP lawyers, quite honestly, they're not in your business rooms. They're not walking through the stores and seeing what your competitors are
right.
selling, and they're not going to have that same perspective.
Yeah, and a lot of times when I'm talking to inventors, they've invented something in their machine shop. Okay, and it's metal. Okay, it's stainless steel and screws and stuff like that, and they'll say, "This is the invention. I want to patent this." I'm like, "Well, is there other ways of doing this? You know, maybe extruding this and making it out of plastic instead of metal. And they're just like a deer in the headlights, you know, that, well, maybe, but this is what I want to patent. I'm like, well, you need to think about people, you know, if this
succeeds. A few steps down the road.
Yeah, if this succeeds, you know, your competitors are going to do it another way. You need to think about what those other ways are.
Well, also along those same lines, but just a little bit different, is folks who are trying to solve a single problem often don't think about what other adjacent or even not adjacent commercial uses might be appropriate for their same invention. So what happens is that smart third parties will come in and say, well, how have people solved a comparable problem that I have? I'm going to go outside my silo of experience and see how people have solved the same problem. And then you can't go after them because your claims are so narrow. You've basically educated them, and you could have gotten, as you say, money for nothing by licensing your patent rights to them, by thinking broadly by the whole scope of uses on the front end.
Okay. Well, what other mistakes, maybe from a timing standpoint or the types of IP other than patents, have entrepreneurs made?
Well, there's two different questions there. First, let me address the timing. A lot of folks, and this is conventional wisdom, traditional advice, is that patent first, talk later. In most cases, I think that's a huge mistake. Unfortunately, the nature of the beast with law firms and lawyers and malpractice issues is that we have to typically give very hard and fast advice. If you do X, Y will happen. Where in reality, if you can learn more about the situation and understand what their business goals are, then you can actually push some of those times through a little bit more. Now, there is risk associated with that, and lawyers' jobs are typically to mitigate risk, so they're not going to intentionally, unless asked, provide advice that gives rise to risk either for their clients or them. So I believe that, and I strongly recommend in the IP strategy context, that people who think that patents may be something that may be appropriate in the long run for them, sit down with an attorney who's willing to explain the risk to them and say, are you willing to assume these risks? And then if you're willing to assume these risks, and, you know, of course, the lawyer's got to get it in writing and cover herself or himself, but still be willing to provide advice that says, you know, you can go out and talk to some folks. You can go out and test some stuff, and this may be the risk of doing so. But overall, you may end up would end up with a better patent for less money, because you've actually done some prototyping, you've actually gone through and figured out what you need.
Right.
So that's the patent space. I think people patent too early.
Right. Because, you know, I'm a project management professional, and we always have risk identification, risk assessment, and then either risk mitigation or risk assumption. One of the two.
Yeah, and that's just it. But always people come to me and they say, I've run a patent search and I've filed a provisional patent. Say, well, who are your customers? And they have no idea. Well, how do you know what your product looks like if you don't even know what your customers want? And folks who actually do prototyping tell me that a very frequent occurrence is people come to them and they've spent, you know, $10,000, $15,000 on the patenting process, and their patent claims don't cover a product that anybody would care about.
Yeah, I've looked at a lot of provisionals that inventors have done themselves, and it's basically the back of an envelope with no anticipation of what kind of claims are going to be in the non-provisional. None.
Yeah. And that's the apocryphal, if you will, send an envelope to yourself, and you're protected. You know, if it really worked, we would hear more about it being
it was that simple. Just mail letters to yourself.
Exactly. Yeah, it doesn't work that way.
Right. And then you need more than one, because if more than one person approaches you, right, you have to show it.
Yeah, it's just apocryphal. It's just like people.
It's like an urban myth.
Exactly.
Won't go
it's
away.
A very persistent urban legend, let me tell you.
Yeah. And the other question you ask, Ron, is one of my strong advocacy positions is that some people don't even need patents.
Bingo.
And they, you know, if you go to a patent attorney, then, you know, as I started the conversation with, and then, you know, that's honestly sometimes a foregone conclusion, not for any lack of ethics, but it's just the nature of the beast.
Right. It's like if you go to a surgeon, you know, they only get paid if they cut you, so they're not going to go, you should just exercise. Don't worry about it. Yeah, no charge. It's okay.
That's my, actually, I was laughing. That's my exact, yeah, you don't go to a surgeon unless you've been diagnosed first.
Right.
And that's that's just the way things are. But for a lot of folks, corporations, entrepreneurs alike, you know, you've got a product that's got a 6-month timeline. Why do you need a patent? It takes four years to issue on average,
right,
these days.
By the time it comes out, you're done with
your patent. Or you've got a, I know Ron, I won't say specifically what client it is, but he's got a client that's got a doodad product. There's probably only one competitor. There's probably no competition for that product because there are not enough potential customers for that. He's going to probably make a very good living on that product, but it wouldn't be rational for a myriad of other folks to come out and knock
into
off
that space, yeah, right? There's not enough business.
So I think he needs a patent, but he probably doesn't need much more than the patent in that regard. Other folks, and I've had conversations recently with clients that, you know, if you file for a patent, you may be patentable, but at the end of the day, you're going to be showing everybody what you do. You're going to be, as we say, opening the kimono.
Right.
And you've got an invention. Yeah, you may get a patent, but you have no way of understanding whether anybody's ever going to be infringing you. How are you going to, as we say, how are you going to police this? Or if you can police it, the infringement's going to be happening in a foreign country. I don't want any of my clients litigating in a foreign country. You know, it just doesn't make sense from an economic perspective.
Right, no.
So, there are a lot of other ways to do this, that don't involve patents. But I really enjoy sitting down with entrepreneurs and business folks who realize there's things they don't know, and they don't know this because they don't teach this in B school. You know, there are people at the highest levels of major corporations who have no clue,
right,
about this.
Now, can you talk a little bit? Let's circle back a little bit to your beginnings. Like, you came from the corporate structure, and now you're dealing with the Wild West of entrepreneurs. That, from a culture standpoint, that must be, you know, a major shift for you.
Well, I did have some independent inventors and college professors. Being married to one, I can tell you they're a little wacky over the years in private practice. But yeah, it is kind of a culture shift. But I'll tell you, I found entrepreneurs tend to be much more receptive to, you know, out of the box, if you will. I hate that phrase, but out of the box ways of looking at things because they have no preconceived notions. What I found at the large corporations, both as an outside attorney and as an in-house person, is that the traditional ways of doing things tend to have a lot more permanence in large corporations.
So that's the way we've always done it, and you just keep doing it that way.
Exactly. And so, you know, if it's risky, the lawyers will say, hey, that's risky, don't do it. And the C-level or senior vice president folks will say, well, our attorney, his job is to manage our risk.
No.
So yeah,
that's his job.
And that's actually very, saying no is very saliently, because when I interviewed the large corporation, I talked to an innovation person, and I said, well, didn't know what to ask. You know, I said, what do you want in a patent attorney? What would be your ideal patent attorney? And she said, oh, I just want a patent attorney that does more than say no.
Okay. Well, I know that there's something about large corporations that seems to stifle innovation, okay? And I know that where I used to work, that if there was something that we wanted to do, we wouldn't ask the attorneys. We would do it, and then we would tell them, okay, cover us. And if it was something that we didn't want to do, we'd send it to the attorneys.
And, it'd be easy out, right?
Well, it'd be 6 months before we got an answer, and the answer would always be, no, don't do it. It's too risky.
Yeah. And I don't want to beat up on in-house attorneys, because I have a lot of friends who are very good in-house attorneys, but they're just prisoners in
Well, that's
part.
How they're judged.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
One big lawsuit and, you know, all the wheels come off, and they point to them. It's like, how'd you let this happen? You know, they're the fall guy.
Yeah, and the other part of that is corporate law departments are cost centers. Every dollar that is spent on lawyers is a dollar that doesn't go to the bottom line.
Right.
So the goal and the incentives are directed toward reducing the costs.
Mm-hmm.
So reducing costs typically means that you're mitigating risk. So you're going to take the path of least risk.
Right.
Well, an entrepreneur, if they're just starting out, how can they use your services?
Well, I love to sit down with entrepreneurs on the early stage and basically find out. The first question I ask is, when do you want to exit? Not if you want to exit, when do you want to exit?
Mm-hmm.
And what do you see yourself doing in 3 or 5 years? Who do you see as your potential acquirer or exit strategy, however you do that? And that, when you ask folks that, they move beyond this, I've got this really great invention, I've got this really great business idea, and start thinking more broadly about the future. And that is a great way to get folks thinking about the need for intangible assets and intangible mm-hmm. asset protection. And that's intangible assets, I should say, are the broad category that includes IP, but also includes other things like your customer lists and your relationships that you have with folks. And sometimes your contracts, your relationships you have with people are more important than a patent, because this is a contractual obligation somebody has to you. They're not going to buy from somebody else.
Right.
So you don't necessarily need a patent. So if somebody tells me that they have really good business relationships and that they spend a lot of time on that, I said, well, you should cultivate those mm-hmm. and figure out how to value that. Because what entrepreneurs don't do, and large corporations do, it's very difficult to value intangibles. People usually put their finger up in the air and make up a number.
Right, some arbitrary number.
Exactly. But what I advise entrepreneurs, love it on an early stage, because then they incorporate this into their ongoing business plan, is that if you identify, capture, and protect your intangible assets, be it IP or mm-hmm. the broader rubric of intangible assets, then those will necessarily go into your balance sheet, and you will be able to identify a value to various aspects of your business that will make you potentially a much better target for
right.
other folks, because you're not saying to somebody, hey, I got a whole lot of goodwill, buy me. You're
right.
saying, I have all this intangible asset.
Look here at this piece of paper that lists it all.
Exactly. You know. So you're coming up on an exit strategy that's a really great way to move forward to that.
Right.
But also why I like to talk to folks in the front end, or not when I'll talk to them anytime, and I always could create value ongoing. But in the early stage, I want folks to look at their intangible assets, their IP strategy, the same way they look at, is it time to buy new furniture? Is it time to buy new equipment? Is it time
right.
to hire somebody else? Build that into their ongoing business plan.
Right.
And to make it part of their business.
Right. And you mentioned your blog, but you have a website that has a lot of information on it.
Yes.
Yeah,
well, the website is the primary place. The blog is the primary place, ipassetmaximizer.com. I also have jackiehutter.com and patentmatchmaker.com, which is a service that I provide.
A dating service for patent holders?
You
said there were no stupid questions. Yeah. So.
No, actually, I think that's cute. But I don't set patents up. But I do I do work to help folks who want to sell their patents, to give them reality-based advice about who might be a potential person for them to buy. And a lot of times I have to tell people, you know, the guy with the singing tip jar, I had to tell him, great patent, strong patent, you've got a really strong, good patent, you've got your money's worth, but nobody's going to buy this.
Good luck with that.
on eBay.
Yeah, how has social media marketing helped you get where you are today?
Well, I think for anybody who's got a new business model, who's trying to push a new business model through the, and get people's attention.
Right.
You can go and meet people over and over again, but if you're not fishing in the right pond, all that time is wasted. So what social media has allowed me to do is actually have the fish swim to the bait, if you will. They're
right.
searching for information. They know there's a problem.
And you show up.
And I'm here, and I'm
right.
sleeping. Or I'm out having dinner with my family. It's always there. And so I think for entrepreneurs who've got something new and different that can't really that it's going to be harder to identify a potential customer. The customers you want, the customers to come to you. Social media is just amazing.
And what's the mix of social media? I mean, there's Twitter, there's Facebook, there's
what works best for you. LinkedIn.
LinkedIn.
Oh,
blogs.
I don't use LinkedIn at all.
Hmm?
And from an expert perspective, I don't find it useful.
But your targets are mostly startups, right?
Yes, yes.
So where do you find startups, like through TweetUps?
I do TweetUps. I do Twitter, and I find a lot of folks. And Twitter helps your page. It helps your page ranking. Mm-hmm. I also use some for lawyers. There's a site called jdsuper.com, which posts legal documents. So I repackage my blog posts. I also use other content marketing e-zine articles. I repackage my
uh-huh.
blog posts on that. And the goal is, if somebody's typing in IP strategy or patent strategy, I want to be on the first page of Google, and without having to pay huge amounts of
money for that.
And my marketing budget is almost zero.
Right.
And anybody who goes to jackiehutter.com will see a pretty ugly website. I'm now in the middle of WordPress upgrade, and I'm learning that myself, because I think that's very important to be
right.
able to do that content marketing on yourself. But it's been a great experience, because it's about me. It's about what I do. I can't. I, I've I've determined that I can't let somebody else handle that for me.
Right.
Okay. So what recommendations do you have for people that might want to enter the world of social media marketing?
Lurk.
Lurk first. Lurk before you post.
Lurk before you do anything, because, and I found it very beneficial in creating my blog persona and the subjects I wanted to blog about, because I've been an avid blog reader for years. So I knew which blogs I liked and didn't like them, why I liked them and didn't like them. And it can be very confusing, but I was able to jump in fairly quickly. But what I've seen, and actually have an online friend on Twitter who actually had to remake his reputation, because the persona he chose was not the persona that was going to lead to the best type of although it wasn't primarily about client generation, it was difficult to understand what he was doing and why he was doing it. And it's been a little bit of a job for him to unwind himself and get mm-hmm. back to where now he knows who he wants to be and why he wants to be there, but he's got an existing social media infrastructure out there that is confusing to folks.
Right, it's incongruent maybe.
Yeah, exactly. So what I tell folks is, look out, start reading some blogs. Start looking at what people you like on Twitter and following what they're doing. Comment on blogs and that kind of stuff and see how that goes. And then kind of develops, hey, I feel comfortable here, because it's about being comfortable.
Right.
People don't follow people who spam. People don't follow people who do the same thing 10,000 other people do on Twitter.
Right.
They follow people that they have interest in, who maintain a persona, and provide valuable information.
Right.
And that's the key, because you don't want numbers. When I see somebody has 20,000 Twitter followers on Twitter, I don't follow typically. And they probably drop me because they're professional Twitterers. But the goal is to have a solid core of high-level followers who also have high-level followers, and that all builds into this density that we need to have to have really good page rankings
right.
and stuff.
So it's back to quality, not quantity.
Yes. And I think that's I like to think of it more of density.
Density.
Yes, okay. As a chemist, yes.
Okay. But it's back to do the research and then think about.
And do you believe in, like, doing one social media tool at a time? Or, like, should you dive in and do Twitter and Facebook and everything?
Maybe it's because I have a short attention span, but I'm a big grazer. I do a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just kind of feeling, because I think that when you start seeing conversions in different media sources,
right.
then you kind of, at least for me, I figure that that I've reached a point of convergence.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of, maybe I've got some density there, or I've got some half. But real briefly, I just want to say why I don't use LinkedIn. I use LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn. Anybody wants to find out about me, look at my resume, it's there. But what I've found from the standpoint of folks who are experts like me is that the fact that there's no peer review with regard to questions and answers
right.
and that kind of stuff makes me a little bit concerned, because I see answers when people post patent questions or IP questions
right.
or other types of questions.
They're like,
I can't
crazy.
Say. I right. can't say, this person doesn't know what they're talking about. Everything is graded at the same level
right.
on LinkedIn. Whereas Twitter or blogs are rated by what people say, what people follow. And
right.
if somebody's saying something stupid, you'll get flamed
right.
on your blog.
Someone will let you know.
Exactly.
That is not
so,
the right answer.
Yeah, so,
like,
so
what were you thinking?
So from a standpoint of important, LinkedIn is important, but I use it. I caution people not to put too much.
Don't put all your eggs in that LinkedIn
exactly.
basket.
Or to people who post on LinkedIn.
Right.
Okay. Well, Jackie, thank you so much for
thank
giving
you.
Us a very fresh look at IP strategy and how social media fits into that.
Thank you so much.
Okay. And this has been another exciting issue of Launch with Lee Cantor and our special guest, Jackie Hunter.